Welcome to We Are Chafee's Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of humanness, community, and well-being rooted in Chafee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today I'm talking with Silvana Montero. Silvana has a really interesting perspective based on some big life experiences that started at a young age. So we talk about those early years, which were spent growing up in three different countries with notably distinct cultures and different languages. Then we get into the heart of a life-changing incident that happened 14 years ago. Silvana, a road cyclist, recounts the harrowing experience and the, I don't know, divine instruction that she heard in that instant that saved her life when she was hit from behind by a motorist driving more than 45 miles per hour. That led to the first of two traumatic brain injuries she has been living with since. So, traumatic brain injuries, TBIs. This was a learning opportunity for me, for sure. Maybe it will be for you, too, as I imagine it will be for many. We get into the very lengthy list of what day-to-day challenges are for Silvana, and can be for anyone who suffers a TBI. She lived a very vibrant and curiosity-filled, adventuring life prior to that moment in 2010 when the first accident happened. She still lives that way as much as possible, but you'll hear how her life has changed, including the social isolation and grief that came with loss of friendships along the way, and how we can show up for our loved ones in those critical moments. We also touch on BC Bits, her creative work that's about getting our ride smiles on. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority. Show notes, including links and a full transcript of this and all Looking Upstream conversations, are available at wearechafee.org. You can support the podcast by following We Are Chafee Pod on Instagram and the We Are Chafee account on Instagram and Facebook. Now, here we go with Silvana Montero. I know you were born in South America, in Uruguay. How long were you there?
I was young. I was only five when we moved.
When you moved to Canada?
We moved to Canada, outside of Montreal. My dad had already been there, I think for about a year, getting work and a place to live and things like that. It was during a, you know, time of turmoil in South America, so we were lucky to get out through friends and this and that.
So that is why the family moved?
That's one of the biggest reasons, yeah. Also, they foresaw a different future for us. My father was a textile engineer, and he was in textile and apparel and things like that, and worked for a global company at the time. And
so you were five. That's a fairly young age, but do you have any memories of your time there?
Mm-hmm. I actually do. I remember the house we were at, my aunt's house. I've been back since a lot, so my aunt's house probably was a memory a lot from that. But had five, you know, at the time I didn't have five cousins. I had four cousins at the time, an older brother, and our little house. And I remember my brother and I, we had bunk beds, and he used to scare the heck out of me at night. He used to do that when we were older, too. some things never change. And I remember playing in the park, going to the beach, being popped over waves, you know, by my parents, you know, and just being in the ocean. I'm a beach kid at heart. Love it. I remember my grandparents, my grandma cooking Saturday. We would have a huge Sunday meal, like the entire family, the uncles, the grandparents, the, you know, the whole, the 20 people, whatever, 30, I don't know how many. And she would do the pasta, and I would get to go hang out and help. And that usually meant grating the cheese, and my grandfather sneaking Coca-Cola from under the cupboard and pouring me a little, like, espresso cup full, because we weren't allowed to drink Coca-Cola back then, especially since I think it was, like, the real thing. And
you mean with Coke in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I never needed more energy. I was always, you know, pretty hyper and wound up and going. But I'll never forget those Saturdays with my grandma. And these were my mom's parents. And then my dad's parents as well were there. And
well, you were pretty young. When you moved, who all of your family left?
Our immediate family. It was my father, my mom, my brother, and I. And I remember we went through New York, had a helicopter ride, which is really weird. Landed in Canada and it was snowing. I'd never seen snow. It was just like the most amazing thing. We're driving up our street and I'm like, wow, snow.
Yeah. Do you mean a helicopter ride from New York to Canada?
I have this like really weird memory of that, and I should ask my mom because it's always been there. It's like, I don't know if we had like a helicopter ride from one airport to another.
Yeah, okay.
Or yeah, I mean, you were right across the border there, you know. So I honestly don't know, and probably shouldn't talk about the legal aspects of it all at the time, even though it was a very long time ago.
Okay.
It was probably really difficult for us to do something like that, you know, at that time. People were disappearing in South America, friends, relatives, you know, people my parents knew. Things were kind of crazy.
What were the actions of those people? Meaning, like, were they part of a revolutionary sort of energy and movement of some kind?
Well, or it was the 60s. There was a lot of revolution. There was a lot of political just insanity going on. I'm sure a lot of folks have heard about, you know, people disappearing, being put in stadiums, this, that, the other, you know. The whole group of the Chilean women, you know, walking in circles. They still do it today with their missing sons and children and husbands and all over South America, Brazil, Argentina, and even little Uruguay. Paraguay was bad. You know, it depended what side of the military you were on. Were you on the side of Che? Were you on the side of the government? Were you, a guerrilla extremist? The history there is, it's like every other history. It's usually told by those who win. So we have to remember when we speak of history, I believe that it's his story. You know, from the beginning of time, it's always been his story. And so that's always skewed a little bit. My uncle was in the military, so that was a good and a bad thing. Good thing because we were a little safer. Bad because it was scary. You never knew what was going to happen. But then there was also the regular life. You know, we went to the racetrack. I loved horses. My uncle loved horses. I wanted to be a jockey. I remember being on a horse when I was like 3-4 years old, the first time they, you know, sat me up there by myself and could barely get my legs over the padding, you know.
How is life different in Canada then, besides seeing snow for the first time?
Besides seeing snow, being very cold, and I didn't speak the language. We didn't speak the language. My father did. My father spoke some English. My mom spoke English. She used to work for Pan America. So they were well-traveled before they had us, and even after they had my brother and I, they traveled all over the world on standby, got to visit amazing places and learn so much culture and things like that. Actually, my mom was very, very pregnant, standing in front of the Taj Mahal with me. These days, they probably wouldn't let you fly being that pregnant. But I still have a hard time with Indian food. I love it, but it doesn't love me back. But Canada was, cultural. I mean, geography. You know, we were used to, I was born in Montevideo in Uruguay, and as far as the monte, the mountain, it's a mound. It's, you know, we live up here in the Rockies, and it's really flat down there, you know, it's ocean. We're squeezed in between Argentina and Brazil, you know, and we have sand dunes and piney beaches, which is kind of cool. And then you go to Canada and the pines are stories tall, and the birch trees and cities and cars and snow, so much snow. Like, people go nuts today about, oh, we're getting 2 feet of snow. I'm like, we used to get 8 feet of snow. So, like, you couldn't see stop signs. You flagged your cars on the road because you didn't want the snowplow to take them away.
Right.
And sometimes,
yeah. Wow.
Yeah, sometimes there were no snowplows because they couldn't get through. And you did walk to school in that, by the way.
Uphill both ways?
Nah, it was
but
one,
that's a lot
one
of
way.
Snow. But it's a lot of snow.
It's a lot of snow, and it would be packed. So you would take, like, your toboggan, you know, and go, you know, places with that. And as kids, you played in the snow. We had neighbors who were the same age as our As kids. They were three boys. Eventually, we were three kids. My sister was born there. And we played outside until you just weren't allowed anymore. It's like, you have to come in now, you know, type of thing. So, you know, life as a kid was okay, except for the language.
Was it also French? Did you have French and English around you?
French and English. We spoke Spanish at home. My dad tried to always make sure that we kept speaking Spanish at home. We battled that as kids because, you know, you wanted to be like the other kids, but at the same
right.
time, it's what we spoke. And I know that later on in life, my dad actually wanted to be rid of his accent because it caused, you know, what he believed at the time or how people acted around him and stuff like that, in work situations and so forth. They, you know, that Latin accent wasn't a thing. But being in that cosmopolitan type of area, I don't think it was a big deal. I think to him it was, but not to anybody else. Us as kids, it was a thing because going to school in the morning, you know, you'd get on the school bus. I was kind of the geeky kid, the glasses, buck teeth, the long hair, didn't speak the language. But my brother was big, and he would stick up for me, you know. And even though he didn't understand either, he knew that they were poking fun at me and everything else. And so one day the bus driver came home and told my mom, your son can no longer come to school on the bus. And she's like, why? He's like, well, he's starting fights. And my mom was shocked because my brother's like this big, gentle giant, right? He's like, just would never start a fight. And he's like, well, they're making fun of her, you know? So there was that. But I adapted once, like, grade school started. My brother did defend me a couple times there. I picked up language really quickly. English, French, not a problem. Kept with my Spanish. I also kept to myself a lot. So it wasn't, it was natural for me to do that. So it wasn't an issue being, you know, different.
What did you do by yourself? Was it to sit in a corner and read, or did you just go ride a bike for hours at a time? Like, how did you entertain yourself?
Reading was a big thing. You say that. I had like a closet, literally a closet full of books. I love to read. I read a ton, I played outside, I skated, loved hockey, had to learn a figure skate, but loved hockey.
Why did you have to learn a figure skate?
Because I was a girl.
Well, was that a kind of a social thing, or was that from, say, your mom, or who was it that insisted?
Probably more my father, and social, you know,
expectations
at the time. Girls learned to figure skate, boys played hockey. But in front of our house was a big field, and the city would put up boards and make a rink. And we had the small rink on the side, and then we had the hockey rink, and as well as going to the regular ice rinks, you know. And every evening we'd be out there, and we'd be playing hockey, you know. And
so was, Canadian, right?
Yeah, right. I will come up with that, you know, eh? Every once in a while, yeah. And it's about.
And you lived there until you were, what, 16 or so?
15 going on 16.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then moved to Dallas, Texas.
Yeah.
Another cultural shift.
That was a huge cultural shock.
When was this? What decade are
this
we talking?
This was 1977. It was the year after the Montreal Olympics.
Okay.
So people knew Montreal.
At least if you said, this is where I've just moved in from, there was some sort of cool factor, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were a teenager, you're moving in, I assume, in high school.
Yes. Which was weird because high school in Canada and high school in the U.S. are two very different things. High school started, at least then, I'm not sure how it goes now, but sixth grade on, you were in high school. We didn't have that whole middle school thing.
Was it called high school or just secondary?
It was secondary and high school. I think schools were named both, depending on the language as well. And we did like till 10th grade and, you know, and then 11th, and you did CJIP, which was like a junior college before you went to university and so forth, and came to the States, and all of a sudden you're like backtracking a little bit. They want you to take this class and that class and the other, and you're like, well, I've already had your American history. did you know you had slaves here? No, we didn't. I'm in Texas, right? I mean, so things were like really, honestly, education was backed up a little bit as far as we were concerned. It was interesting, the culture. It was a little scary for me, honestly. I was used to not having issues other than when I was very little and didn't speak the language. But, you know, kids are going to be kids. But as a teenager, we were everything from everywhere up in Canada. You know, there was a whole big deal with the French versus the English and this and that. But as far as your ethnic backgrounds and your color and your accents and this and that, it didn't matter. You know, there was no difference. You know, I never saw a difference anyway. I'm sure there was, you know, there always is a little, but it wasn't a big deal. And we moved to Texas. There were still Klansmen in Texas, like outward, you know,
wowly
seen. There was, schools were pretty much segregated because of law or because of choice. Education was at definitely a lower bar.
Did you find yourself lumped in with those from Mexico or however they might have drawn other in that case because of Spanish heritage? Latin heritage.
They actually were freaked that that I wasn't speaking French because they saw me as Canadian. I don't look Latin, so unless I actually bring it up, nobody knows. You know, they can't unless you know.
Unless they heard you
like
speaking
me,
Spanish.
Unless
with someone.
They heard me, or I've had people occasionally go, "Wow, you really look Basque, or you really look Spanish, or you really look Italian or whatever," but that's a rare case. Those are people that have lived there or from there or something. But otherwise, you know, I'm just your average, you know, a little bit darker than white-skinned girls. So
sure, yeah.
That wasn't it. But they all thought they were surprised that I spoke English. They all thought, being from Montreal, Quebec area, that I would be French.
Okay.
You know, so, and I'm like, you guys, the Olympics were there last year. Did you not notice, you know, people spoke, you know, I actually translated for the Mexico and Argentine equestrian teams when I was in Canada during the Olympics for some of them. We had horses back then. Some of the teams stayed at our barn. And so I got to do a lot of the interpretation and stuff.
That's
like
cool.
That. So that, yeah, that was fun.
These moves that had some significant cultural differences and experiences for you, I wonder how those might have influenced that when you were an adult, when you became an adult, that you would also travel in the world and you would live in some different places. And I wonder how all of that might have factored in to you wanting to explore or to be an adventurous sort of person.
I think I was born a gypsy. And my parents' curiosity of the world and their ability, not financially, because they didn't have any money when we were in Uruguay and stuff like that, but, you know, mom working for Pan Am and all that made it, you know, made the world accessible to them. And Yeah, I was always curious. I'm still really curious. I still have a huge list of places I'd love to go.
There are so many.
There are so many.
I think for those of us who like to travel, there's just always going to be a list of places I'd love to go because there's always going to be, well, where now? Uh-huh. Where next?
Yeah. Like if people ask you, where's your favorite place? And I'm like, I haven't been there yet. You know? It's like, yeah. I know more or less, you know. I've traveled a lot in Europe. We traveled as kids with our parents a lot. We went back to Uruguay as much as possible. Unfortunately, they didn't take us around South America much, but it usually because we were going to see family, you know, so, and honestly, with all the cousins and uncles and grandparents and this and that and the other, I would be exhausted too and not want to drag around my kids for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I love culture, food, music, language, just, you know, the whole human experience, not to, you know, use the cliche, but yeah, it's amazing out there in the world.
It is. And I think that you have been a free spirit who's enjoyed an amount of that. And I'd like for you to describe, if you would, then what that was like going through your 20s, your 30s, your early 40s, kind of the early portion of adult life. What has been your passion in life? What are the things that you have enjoyed doing?
Learning. I think that's been a huge practice in my life. From the time I was a kid, I loved to learn why, who, when, where, what. I used to get in trouble a lot because of why. Old European background, you know, generation, my parents, grandparents, I was, you know, a girl, you don't ask why, you just do, right? But that was never good enough. I wanted to know why. Why not? I'm good with no if you tell me why not, you know? Why and how. How do things work? Love to take things apart. With my neighbor, his dad was a mechanic, and he wanted to be a mechanic. He was the older of the three boys. You know, like, take apart his dad's engine and try to get it back together, you know, before your dad comes home. Things like that, you know. And take apart the bikes, do this, do that. I rode horses. I loved horseback riding. Back to the question, my travels, my world, my passions. Honestly, it all comes from wanting to learn, to experience, to feel, to smell. I think senses are so huge, such a huge part of my life experience.
Curiosity goes so far, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really does.
The reason I said 20s, 30s, early 40s is I've been working our way toward a pivotal experience in your life. That this is who you are. These are the matters in your heart. But then in your late 40s, when you were riding your bike, a motorist hit you from behind when you were on your bike. And that led to your first of two traumatic brain injuries. And this changed your life. And I'm curious to know then, if we go from that vibrant sort of life beforehand, how you might describe that life was changed from that day forward.
Whew. Yeah. Completely derailed my life. I had a big, beautiful, wonderful, not easy, amazing life before that day. I had just come back from a couple of months in Europe. I was training for a big bike ride in Colorado, big, huge mountain ranges. I'm a roadie. I've always been a road bike gal. I love mountain biking. I love all biking. I love motorcycles. I love anything that horses, motos, cars, things that go zoom. Love to go fast. And I was going thankfully fast that morning. I was on a divided six-lane road, quiet. Regular practice. I was training for the ride. I'd just gotten back from Europe, so I'd put on a little weight, ate my way through. And I knew where I was. And I remember stopping at the trailhead, giving a young man directions. He asked me if I wanted to keep riding with him. I said, no, I'm heading home. I've just done my training. I had just killed the music on my earbuds, hopped on the road for my 4 or 5 blocks that I had left to go to my mom's house. I was in Texas at the time. And I never made it. I heard a noise. It was an explosion of metal and glass and screeching, and it was an explosion. I've heard explosions before. I've been in places where bombs have gone off, and that's what it sounded like to me. But I didn't realize that it was me. I don't have much memory. I actually don't remember what you asked me.
Just about how your life changed from that day forward. Yeah, and what that experience was. So I appreciate your description.
Sure. I don't remember much. I three things I tell people that I do remember of that day. And one was that conversation with that young man. Two was the noise. Actually, four things. But three was a different noise. It was a voice. It was this beautiful, beautiful voice. And it said to me three times, hang on to your bike, hang on to your bike, hang on to your bike. And it wasn't my voice, because I know what my voice sounds like. And this thing was, it was like a song. It was beautiful. And I hung on to my bike with all my might. I was hit from behind by a man driving at about 45 plus miles an hour. He admitted to going over the speed limit. He hit my seat, so everything from behind my saddle was pretty much dislodged. I went up onto his hood, through his windshield, onto the roof, and by that time he'd come to a dead stop, and I went flying across the road, still clipped into my bike. Left handlebar over the right, I held so tight, I literally bent it over, and curled up into my little yoga ball, which I think saved my life, that I was quite flexible and bendy. But my head took the hit. Front, rear, side, back, front, again, just boom, 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 boom. I was told by witnesses, I stood up, I unclipped, I stood up, I took my helmet off. I saw that it was ripped apart. The man was getting out of his car. I threw the helmet at him, and then I went back down on the asphalt. I don't remember. I know people stopped. I know they called 911. I know they called my mom. You know, all these things happened, and the only thing I recall was getting into the ambulance, and the paramedics couldn't put me in. The firemen had to pick me up and put me in, and I was hanging on to him for dear life and arguing about getting into an ambulance, saying, make it stop. Just make it stop. And all I can figure was that everything was spinning and moving and just going and loud and crazy, but little me had fought off paramedics, you know, and stuff. And it's like, no, I didn't want to go. And then life changed.
To what do you attribute that voice saying to hold on tight?
You know, I get asked that a lot. Do I believe in angels? Maybe. I believe there's, I don't know, spiritual world out there, that we're all stardust, we're all connected. Somebody, something, even me, I don't know, said, you need to hang on to that bike. It's going to save you. And it physically did. I only broke an ankle bone. Little miracle child at 49. It was
amazing. Besides the head injuries, of course.
Besides breaking my brain, yes. And it was what they consider a closed head, moderate brain injury. So it's pretty severe, except there was no blood on the outside other than, you know, little cuts and scrapes. And my whole body was road rashed and bruised and banged, and I still get splinters every once in a while coming out of joints and things that from that day.
Like splinters of glass?
Metal, glass, road, bone.
And this was around 14 years ago?
14 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I want to note a number of the symptoms of a traumatic brain injury, which you shared with me what your experience has involved. And I want to share that with listeners because I think there might be a number of things we think of with a TBI, which, for example, memory loss. You had 90% loss of your memory for the first 3 years after this accident. You would not recognize yourself in the mirror and get scared. Am I right?
Yes. I had full-on amnesia.
Okay.
And I had no instant recollection.
Okay.
So from literally millisecond to millisecond, that didn't happen.
There's also blurry vision that makes use of screens and reading difficult. There's loss of balance and coordination, difficulty retaining information or participating in conversations, like this one, I assume, is tiring you, possibly. Head, face, and neck pain, nerve pain, migraine, headaches. Aphasia, or loss of words when speaking. There's difficulty with name and facial recognition.
Yeah.
There's impulse control disorder, changes in personality, a loss of filter, hypersensitivity to light and noise. And then some that to me were even less maybe considered or thought of on my part. I wouldn't have necessarily considered the change in appetite that would lead to weight loss and challenges with your nutrition. Loss of skin pigmentation, is that correct?
Yeah, my forehead, my upper left side went white, just in the corner by my hairline, and a whole streak of hair, and my eyebrows and eyelashes turned white and fell out. Thankfully, some grew back.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's not something I would have necessarily expected, so...
It's a trauma. They say severe trauma does that.
Okay. There's also then the chronic mental fatigue. There's paranoia. There's PTSD, time disorientation, depression, low self-esteem, disconnection with others, social isolation, a change or loss of sense of humor. And I think along with all of these challenging changes in your life and to your experience, there is the lack of social support, empathetic understanding of your experience, and that comes from friends, from family, from even sometimes medical care professionals.
Oh, yeah.
And this was not even the full list of your experience or the full list that I imagine others with TBIs experience, and of course did not address any of the physical things. You mentioned your ankle, but you had surgeries on that. You also had then a long physical recovery besides all of these things. I think it's important to share this. I appreciate your having shared the list with me because I think it's educational and it helps us take a step forward in having empathy for those sorts of injuries that we cannot see in a person.
Yeah. You can't see it. It's all in my head, except for the scars and little signs. My eyes will droop. My face will droop. I had palsies from the accident. I start to fidget a lot more than usual. Can't sit still. It hurts. Everything hurts for lots of reasons, but brain injury is a spinal injury. You know, it starts, you know, at your neck, at your head. Women, I just want to add real quick into all of that. Women are more prone to a brain injury because our necks are not as strong as men's, even those who are physically strong. And I was very athletic. I'm still very athletic. 60s or the new 40s. I'll run around circles, most 45-year-olds I know. But yeah, it's a lot of stuff, and there's more. And every single brain is different. Every single brain reacts differently. Every single brain recovers differently. Every single brain, we'll get back to the curiosity. It's a curious thing, the brain.
A mystery.
Yeah.
To a lot of us. Yeah. Maybe to everybody. I mean, do medical professionals, those you've dealt with, do they have a good sense of this?
They can see things a lot better now than they did years ago. Even during my time, I was dismissed from the hospital that same day, by the way.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I was sent to a neurologist who said I'd be fine once my memory came back. Yeah, that was a lie.
Where did this accident happen?
In Dallas.
So you were, and your mother still lives there,
my
right?
My mother still lives there.
So then did you go from that accident to having her, like, were you living with her for
yes.
that care period and amnesia and things?
I was living with her, thank goodness. I was a teacher back then. Obviously could not go back to school. I don't recall retiring. I don't recall cleaning out my classroom. I don't know. Almost 3 years of amnesia, which I've gotten some memories back. I went to Patagonia, Chile, Uruguay.
During that time,
I wandered around Big Bend Park all by myself. I did a lot of things that I probably shouldn't have. I probably should not have been allowed to, but because I was so misdiagnosed, and brain injuries are not a sudden whammy, here are all the symptoms and effects at once. It's a bit of a roller coaster, sometimes a little smoother valleys and hills type of thing. Symptoms come and go. Some are huge and obvious and noticeable, and like, you know, like the amnesia, or if you're physically off, or this, that, and the other. The sensitivities to sight and noise, and some of those are kind of obvious. Like, you know, I have severe tinnitus. They said some of that would go away. No, it just is intensified through the years. But I didn't look like anything was wrong. I have really strong language skills, so I faked it. I really faked being okay, because I kept being told, I guess, that I was going to be okay. And I woke up every morning and for those few first seconds thought, oh, got to get up and go to work, be a teacher. But then I would sit up and my whole world would just be off because, wow.
I'm in my late 40s, and if you and I went out for a bike ride now, and you mentioned that you could, you know, as an athlete, you could run circles around, you know, somebody much younger, and I wonder, what is the difference between a day when you feel up to whooping me on a bike ride, and maybe what that takes to get you ready for such an effort, or maybe what it takes for you to recover, or, like, what are the real day-to-day effects of that? Because I want to make sure I'm clear and understanding. I don't think you're suggesting that everything is perfectly how it was pre-accident, that you could just ride on any day at any whim of a moment and have that success. So what is the difference between a day when you can perform in the ways that you want to energetically and a day when you can't?
I can no longer perform the way I want to. Let's be completely honest there. I just happen to be very lucky that I'm strong-willed, keep up my physical strength, and just, you know, keep a bitchin' attitude, shall we say. I have days where, every day, actually, I just want to stay in bed. Every day, I don't want to do this anymore. Every day, I get angry. Every day I feel sadness, quite often alone, lonely. I don't have a problem being alone. Let me be very clear about that. I like me. I don't mind my company. I was never big into team sports. I liked the solo sports. I liked my time. For whatever reasons, whole other stories. But to get on a bike and go for a ride, no problem getting there. The recovery could be horrific. I could take a couple hours. It could take a couple of days. You never know. So that makes it difficult. Today's conversation will take at least a day's recovery to mentally function properly. Physically, I'm good. My muscles get sore. I worked out this morning, hopped on the trainer for about 30 minutes, did my PT exercises, this, that, and the other, an hour's workout. I'm not sore, except a little bit in the shoulders because I had to shovel a bunch of snow and gravel the other day. The gravel was the hard stuff. But don't tell my PT. Recovery is really tough, and you never know what's going to cause you to have to recover. You know, it could be a long conversation. It could be a day at work. It could be going to lunch.
Do you feel like you live your life then in with anxiety or fear about, well, if I go do this thing that I want to do, what are the consequences? Or are you that, you know, again, if free spirit is a word that applies, that adventurous, you know, person who's willing to leap, are you willing to take that leap and then say, well, I will take the consequences, whatever they are, that's okay, because I want to go on this bike ride?
Both.
Okay, fair enough, yeah.
Both, and then there's always the third answer, right? What should you do? I'm in anxiety every day about doing things. I have to mentally schedule my brain that you're going to do this till this time of day. And 14 years later, I have not been able to get past the 1:30 bonk time. At 1:30, time change or not, different states, different countries, it doesn't matter. My brain just goes bang.
You mean 1:30 in the afternoon?
1:30 in the afternoon.
That's it for your day.
I start to lose, you know, cognitive skills. My fatigue is just beyond normal. I mean, everybody gets it. Heck, I was a third grade teacher. Yes, that time of the day, you're tired. You know, you want your sugar or coffee buzz or whatever it is, or exercise or fresh air, whatever it gets to wake you up. No, there is no waking me up.
It's an exhaustion far past the norm.
Yeah, it's mental fatigue, and it's really bad. I do events and things. I'm on medications to do those. I don't like to have to take medications, but I will fall asleep, like, after a shower in the morning. I get really tired taking a shower, if that makes sense. I know it sounds crazy, but it's exhausting. I don't know why it shouldn't be mentally. It's not physically exhausting, but it's mentally exhausting.
Is it the executive steps of anything like that where it's like, okay, mentally I need to think, okay, I do this first, then I need to do this step, then I need, is it going through those that tires the brain?
A lot of it, yeah. Like more than 2 or 3 step instructions. Yeah, that's a lot of thinking involved.
Cooking by a recipe would be a lot.
Oh, yeah, my cooking's interesting. Thankfully, I'm not a baker. I bake a couple of things, but baking's hard because baking, you have to follow the recipes to, you know, pretty much to a point, unless you're really good in experimenting. So I like to cook because then you can, you know, what happens, happens. What you got, what you can throw in there, what you have to spare in the fridge, you know, spices, this, that, the other, it's all good. That's how I feel my life is. Whatever's in the mix, if I can do it and it comes out okay, great. If not, well, we'll just keep trying.
You had a second accident in 2017, right? So about 7 years, around 7 years later, at any point, have you asked, why me? Why did this happen? And why did it happen a second time, for crying out loud?
Yeah. I'm sure we all who experience any kind of trauma, physical, mental, whatever in their life, think that, why me? I am so much luckier than so many people I know, especially with brain injury. Because I get to sit here and talk to you about it. Why me? Yeah, that one really pisses me off. I'm a good person. I believe I'm a good human. My whole life, I've honestly loved really big. I give of me whatever you need. I'm that way. I'm really open in that respect. I'm communities, individuals, whatever. And then stuff like that happens and you're like, well, wait a minute. I've got stuff to do. And I get pissed. I get angry because I think it's not fair, because I really do have a lot of stuff to do that I want to do and that I have to do. Maybe I don't have to in the great scheme of the world and humanity, but in my heart, yes, you know, and I can't. And it makes me sad. It makes me sad because I want to go bum around Europe some more. I traveled by myself a lot, by the way, just easier. I have a couple friends that are great to travel with. And I miss that. I miss that life. I miss learning. I miss my friends.
I think the piece of lost friends and social isolation is really important and useful for you, if you will share with us what that experience is and why you think that might happen.
It's one of the things they tell you. I know because I wrote it in a book. People are going, well, if you had amnesia, how do you remember all these things? I said, I wrote it down. I journaled. I've always journaled, and I journaled all during this journey. Friends, some stayed until they realized that, oh, she's not coming back. Some went away right away. I can't recall who showed up, because honestly, I think there were only two that actually showed up.
Why do you think more did not?
Because people believe that I am me, that I was still invincible, that I was still Sylvana, who organized everything, who instigates everything, who's always going and doing and being, and because I looked okay. And, you know, you post happy pictures, right? I don't know. Honestly, I can't say that they didn't care about me. I can't say that they didn't love me. I know I love them, care about them. I just think that people are not all people are equipped to deal with stuff, different things. Some of it is lack of empathy, and it's a whole debate whether that's learned or intrinsic to your nature.
I think that people, when they get uncomfortable with how to be with someone, how to sit with someone, how to just have that empathy and listen, I think sometimes we turn away from it because we don't know how to show up and be that person.
Yeah.
And I think then there might be a pile of guilt and shame. The longer we go without showing up for you or for that person in our lives who might have needed us to show up, I think we feel worse and worse, and so we turn farther and farther. And so I wonder if there is something you might be able to share with all of us, that if there is someone in our lives or someone in the future that we need to show up for, or maybe would want to, how can we do that and not be hung up on the awkwardness of our own discomfort and not knowing how to show up in some perfect way for them? What would you have liked for your friends who did not come in to have done? What would you like them to know that they could have done and it would have been okay?
To just do it. Honestly, that, because I forgive you, all of you, and there's a lot. Family, friends, doctors, lawyers, police. There's a big list of people I forgive during this journey, because you didn't know better, because you couldn't handle it, because you didn't understand, because you didn't know what to do with those feelings. I had one person actually say to me, I don't know how to be with you anymore.
Were they putting that on you, or were they saying that about themselves?
I think both. because I was tired. So I was a little cranky. I was hungry. And I was upset. And I was like, please, you need to give me, and I remember this conversation of, you need to give me this time in quietness, and I need downtime. And I'm very good about saying, I need downtime. I need to stop. I need to go now, or I'm done, or I'm hungry, or I need to close my eyes, or whatever it is that I need, I'm very verbal about. And somehow this person got angry with me because I wasn't who I used to be, or the way I used to be. I'm still me, but there's a stranger that's taken up residency in my head and won't leave. And you're going to have to deal with her too.
If I would have been your friend at that time and I was afraid to show up because I felt like I needed to have the perfect words and be that perfect support system, I think what I'm hearing you say is that you would have really preferred, rather than my hideaway, that I just show up and be imperfect. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
That would have had a lot more meaning and value to you if I would show up and be willing to say things in not the best way, but show that I loved you by being there for you.
That would have been great. That would have been amazing. I always say, you know, I'm moving forward imperfectly. You know, the world's mad. I'm not quite sane, which is a good thing. Yeah, I mean, I always try to relate to this as it's a chronic for life thing. I hate to call it a disease because it's a disorder. It's something that occurred to me. It's not or was incurred. You know, I wasn't born with depression. I wasn't born with cognitive disabilities. I wasn't born with speech issues. I wasn't born with all these things. I was very, very, very sad a couple of times in my life. Like some, you know, traumatic stuff happened. My best friend, my father, and my dog all passed away within the same few months. And I didn't know how to deal with that stuff. I went through menopause. Most women have a really hard time with that. Me, I just had crazy nightmares. And my kids got cold in class because the hot stuff. But you know, I tell them they just need some fresh air. But honestly, those are the only two times in my life where I've been like really sad. And yeah, these things, you're going to have to give me that question again because I lost my train of thought.
No, that's okay. I actually want to move on to the last question I want to ask you because, as you already expressed, this is taking a toll on you. And I'm so grateful that you are giving us your time and at the cost of the recovery that this is going to require. I want to ask if you would like to share with people about your creative work with BC Bits.
Sure. That's kind of kept me going. BC Bits is me trying to get your ride smile on. It's me having learned to use my brain, my vision, and my hands, my motor skills. They say some people get artistic after brain injuries in really crazy, weird, just imaginable ways. They become musicians, they become artists, they become this, they become that. Me, I lost a lot of stuff, so I had to learn new things. And I learned to bead again, and I learned to do little crafty things, and did some bicycle artwork, and somebody bought it, and from there I started growing. Made apparel, jewelry, upcycled, repurposed parts from bikes, all because I needed something to do, and two, because before my brain injury, I actually had a plan for retirement. As a teacher, I planned to retire doing a business that involved manufacturing women's cycling apparel and getting more women on bikes, hopefully with the money we made, and getting sponsorships and things in countries through the Americas. There's a lot of this happening in Africa and Asia and all these other places, but not enough of it, or at least at the time, in Central and South America, where bicycles are really, really needed. My goal was to get more women on bike, have them teach other people how to ride, have Central Bike World Ride Cosm Libraries. They have an amazing program they do like this. Anyway, that was my whole thing with BC Bits, before the accident, after the accident. I couldn't do all those things, so I just started with little artwork and apparel design and doing events and working with charities. I volunteered for Brain Injury Networks and programs with Safe Street and Trail Initiatives and underdeveloped countries where I can, and neighborhoods as well. Those that are not well represented, well, here goes the word thing, underrepresented communities where bikes are really needed, bike repairs are needed, things like that. So that's what BC Bits is. And COVID was hard. Then bike shops started closing, and a couple of my other shops started closing. So it's been a little tougher on business. So I'm kind of shifting gears, shall we say, and moving on, going to keep doing it, just a little bit different moving forward.
Okay.
But I'm still going to try to support all the causes and share awareness of what's going on in my head.
I will include the website address and the Instagram handle for BC Bits in the show notes that are going to be on wearechafee.org. So we'll help people be able to find that and learn more about what it is you're doing. Silvana, thank you very much for everything you've shared and for everything you're putting out for this conversation, energy-wise, to sit here with me. I feel honored for that, and I'm grateful to you.
Well, no, I'm grateful to you, Adam. Thank you. Thanks for letting me share what people don't see. And there's millions. Just want to let you know out there, there's millions of us here in the U.S., never mind the whole world, with brain injuries. Don't forget that every concussion is a brain injury. So don't let it slide that you're okay. If you're not okay, get out there and get some help. Talk about it. Share it. That's the only way people will know, because we look okay. It's all in our heads.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for listening to the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast. If our conversation here today sparked curiosity for you, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechafee.org. If you have comments or know someone in Chafee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email us at info@wearechafee.org. We invite you to rate and review the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use with that functionality. We also invite you to tell others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado, to Heather Gorby for graphic and web design, to Andrea Carlstrom, director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, community advocacy coordinator for the We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. The We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chafee County Department of Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and it's supported by the Colorado Public Health and Environment Office of Health Disparities. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast and related storytelling initiatives at wearechafee.org and on Instagram and Facebook at We Are Chafee. Lastly, until the next episode, as we say here at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.